So welcome to the Laravel IO podcast. My name is Sean McCool, and I'm joined by Ian Landsman, creator, founder of Userscape and HelpSpot, and Snappy Help Desk Software, right? HelpSpot and Snappy?
That's right.
And Dan Syme, creator of Cardless, who focuses on creating framework-agnostic developer middleware. So I'm really happy to have you both on today. You're both huge contributors to the community and Laravel in general. Ian, you recognized the value of Laravel early in the game, and you ended up hiring Taylor, the author of the framework, and you've also been funding a lot of the development, maybe even a majority of the development now, right? By allowing Taylor to work on it during company time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd say the majority of the development, but we do give him a week each month, and you know, there's also like just today actually, Taylor added something to Laravel that we needed for Snappy. So it's kind of a nice symbiotic relationship there where we're building this application and, you know, I think, you know, he definitely gets a lot of interesting ideas from this kind of real-world experience. So, yeah, it's really kind of interesting and cool to work this closely with the creator of the framework. So changes get implemented quite quickly, which is nice. And we can kind of kick things around when there's something new that's needed and things like that. So it's pretty cool.
So what are your primary justifications for actually paying for open source software to be created?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Like, you know, I think when people first hear about it and especially when we kind of first hired Taylor and maybe right around like when version 3 of Laravel was coming out, when it was really starting to pick up some steam, you know, people like make the equation that's like, oh, you know, it's like Rails and 37 signals and it's that kind of thing. But, you know, that was like a kind of a moment in time, and that's not really the real world at this point. So, yeah, you know, the number one reason is just because I really love Laravel. I hate, you know, working in PHP without it. And we have a lot of stuff at Userscape that still doesn't use it because, you know, we've been around for almost 10 years. So we have back office systems and HelpSpot, which is still our primary product, you know, is not yet on Laravel. So, you know, there's still a lot of old, nasty code we have to touch. But I just really, you know, really love using it. And so that's really the primary motivation. And two, I've always wanted to be involved in it. I'm not a good enough developer to make any sizable contribution in terms of actual code. So it's kind of cool to be able to give back in this way. And, you know, obviously our whole company is built on PHP and other open source products and libraries and things of that nature. So it's just cool to give back. It's, you know, it's not a moneymaker by any means, but it's pretty cool to be involved in something that's really popular like this. And, you know, we have a lot of fun doing the conferences and doing podcasts like this and just getting to kind of participate in the larger open source community. So, you know, that's really, really the main motivation. And, you know, and it's great to work with, you know, great people like Taylor and Eric, who works with us, has had a lot of success now in, you know, doing things in Laravel with his wardrobe blog application. And, you know, it's just kind of cool to see and be a part of, you know, this kind of renaissance of PHP. So it's really, really cool and fun.
Yeah, that is cool. I'm really enjoying, you know, just being a player in the whole new PHP thing. Just,
yeah.
Well, you know, anybody getting in there and digging in open source stuff now is having a blast, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like any old time PHP people, like you're involved in it now. And it's like, I mean, it's a totally different world. I mean, I remember, you know, digging around on phpclasses.org or com or whatever it was and like trying to find some tidbit of code you could like reuse, and there was no centralized anything, and you know, there was no, you know, back when I really started, there wasn't even frameworks. So there was no frameworks, there was no help, you just, you know, slapped a bunch of PHP in a file and called it a day and kind of waded your way through it. So it's really amazing to see what you can do now in just a few hours. I mean, HelpSpot version 1 I could have built in 2 weeks, you know, with Laravel 4 when it took me 6 months the first time. So it's really amazing to see how things have progressed.
Yeah, Dan, so probably not a lot of our listeners know about Ben Corlett, but probably most people are familiar with Cardless in general. But I know Ben specifically has been a pretty large contributor to the framework, as he's been working on the Arsenal. I know that the Cardless Arsenal is a collection of middleware, but it's framework agnostic, so you can use it in different frameworks, and Laravel is just one of them. But during the development of these tools, he submitted a lot of bug fixes and various types of improvements to Laravel, both 3 and 4. So I'm personally very interested in your business, Dan. I think middleware is a really cool market because you can kind of write to your peers and sort of live up to ideals. And, you know, maybe you're an idealist person, I don't know, you tell me. But I think when you're writing middleware, you're kind of getting the chance to make the world a little bit better of a place. Can you tell me a little bit about your business and what it's like building a business out of targeting developers?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we started out as a business model not going into this whole thing with developing middleware. We knew we wanted to create a new e-commerce platform because we all come from e-commerce. You know, we grew up on Zen, OS Commerce, and Magento, and a lot of those shopping carts. And about 3 years ago, you know, I went to my partner and I said, hey, you know, why don't we find a framework? We do client sites on different frameworks like CodeIgniter, but why don't we create our own e-commerce platform? Try to get something out there that's a little bit more developer-centric. And that just kind of evolved into this, you know, that first idea, okay, we need to find a framework. So we started off in CodeIgniter, and we went to Fuel, and then Laravel came out, and that was just a huge boost for us because we switched over. Things were just more elegant. It really lended us an opportunity to get on the ground floor of something as well. So we continued on that path of creating an e-commerce platform, and it turned out that since we wanted everything to be so developer-centric that we started to create this platform that really based on, I think at the time it was bundles with Laravel 3, didn't really require you to, you know, make everything specific to an e-commerce platform. You could develop a lot of bundles that did one thing and do it really, really well. And then when Laravel 4 came out and Composer came into the picture, man, that just like blew our minds, and that allowed us to create things like, you know, Sentry 2, which adopted that framework agnostic mentality. And, you know, we primarily develop everything on Laravel, but that whole framework agnostic way of doing things has just been really great for us. So, yeah, from there we just started creating packages, framework agnostic packages that do, like, one thing very well. We have, like, nested sets, which handle hierarchical data sets. Sentry, which is our open source contribution that's free to everyone, handles authorization and authentication. And our e-commerce platform is still there, but it's kind of been pushed out into the future where we're working on it, but we're really focusing on the infrastructure and kind of almost crowdfunding the development of Cardlist with you know, our arsenal of packages and extensions that do that middleware thing, like user management and you know, menu management, things like that. So that's essentially what our business model is. And that's kind of the route that we've been taking.
So how, okay, both of you seem to me like people who hire well. Like, I've met your developers and, you know, I'm fairly impressed. And I'm kind of curious, how do you approach scouting talent?
Yeah, well, for me, I'll just jump in and go first. you know, I've done a fair amount of hiring in my sort of previous lives. But actually, we hired Eric and Taylor at basically the same exact time. And, you know, I'd like to say it was entirely just, you know, we dug through millions of people and it was really intense. But honestly, you know, Eric was recommended to us and, you know, he just seemed like a really good fit. And then actually, sort of interesting side story is that through Eric's GitHub, you know, repos, I found Laravel that he had forked and was playing with, and that's how I actually found Taylor. And then I just approached Taylor because I figured anybody who built something that was this cool, you know, would probably be a pretty good developer. And he's also turned out to be a really great, just like cultural fit, and you know, a really great addition to the team beyond his obvious development skills. But yeah, I think that at least for me, there's a lot that goes into it. You know, it's about the tools, and I know there's a lot of, you know, the skills, and there's a lot of people out there who would say that's the only important aspect. But especially when you're really small or you're bootstrapped or you're, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, I think that the kind of cultural aspects are almost equally important to the actual technical skills, because when you're trying to develop a product, you know, customers don't really care about the technical aspects of it, and, you know, better code does give you an advantage, but it's definitely not the only aspect or even necessarily the most important aspect, you know, when you're trying to build a product and everything that entails with marketing and customer support and all the other aspects to it. So I do think that, you know, a little bit of advice would definitely be to always keep that kind of cultural aspect in mind.
Now, can I jump in there for a second? When you're talking about cultural aspect and you're talking about like kind of like the holistic approach, like taking into consideration the business and everything, like really, how would you define somebody who's a good fit? So if you're a developer and, you know, you're trying to be, you know, you're professional and you're seeking to pursue your profession and to, you know, rise up the ladder, not necessarily of just, you know, job positions, but you want to be really good at what you do. What does it mean to step away from improving when it comes to working on the code? What skills does it take to kind of be that person that you want to hire?
Yeah, so I can give you some examples. So definitely anything that brings you out of your kind of pure comfort zone of slapping down code, all that stuff is really good. And nowadays, obviously, there's so many things online. Like, the first thing everybody's going to do is search online and see what you're up to. So you want to, you know, be out there, I think, is the first thing, and make yourself findable, put stuff up on GitHub and all those kind of things that are, you know, becoming fairly standard. But, I mean, we've, you know, even gotten resumes recently from developers who don't, you know, they're not on Bitbucket, they're not on GitHub. You know, they're just kind of, they're not out there at all. And so, you know, that person's a little bit harder to hire just right off the bat, because you can't just take a look and get a feel for them even code-wise up front. But then, you know, for instance, Eric, you know, has some entrepreneurial background where he had his own business. That's a great thing. That might be, you know, not everybody can just start their own business or wants to start their own business, but, you know, that's something to highlight. In Taylor's case, just a simple little thing, like, I really loved the Laravel documentation. Like, I was able to get up and running with Laravel instantly. So I'd been actually going through different frameworks at the time, separate kind of from the hiring process, and seeing how horrible the documentation was in most of them, and or just purely non-existent. And to have this... I was going to leave the name out, but okay. So, so yeah, so, you know, so then you find this framework and it's like, okay, it looks kind of cool. And, but there's more than just code examples. It was like really well thought out and, you know, pretty completely documented, well written. So just to even get that sense of somebody who took the time, the care to like not just put the code part together, which is the fun, cool part everybody wants to do, but to do the kind of boring part of, all right, I'm going to sit here and write out pages and pages of documentation and examples, and I'm going to do it well. It's not just going to be 200 slapped together examples with, you know, a half a line of text kind of gluing them together, but it's going to be thought out and logical. You know, that was something that right away caught my eye as, you know, that this person had more to them than just being, you know, a really good programmer, that there was, you know, more there. And especially, again, in a small business, you know, you're going to be asked to do things other than program almost always. So, you know, you're writing blog posts or you're writing documentation on the product or, you know, you're doing customer service or you're, you know, you're working directly with customers on problems they're having with the software. So, you know, you need to, as much as you can, try to find ways to show those other sides of yourself. And, you know, I think open source is still a great way to do that, you know. Write a great README for your little open source library. Like, that's a huge thing that somebody's going to notice.
That's a huge thing. You know, for us, when we hired Ben and Bruno, I've gone through the route of hiring people through agencies, and that's just kind of horrible. I've gone the route of accepting resumes, and that's horrible. Doing interviews, you know, just I've never hired somebody through an interview process where I just put out an ad or went and looked for somebody that was looking for work. I've always gone to the place that I am interested in hiring about. So for like Ben and Bruno Gaspar, who's another one of our developers, who's just great, wonderful guy and a hard worker, it was about, you know, going into the IRC, looking at the people that were involved and looking at what they were doing, seeing how they wrote their code on GitHub, how they interacted with other people. And every person that I've hired from there has always has turned, you know, they're still with us today.
So are Bruno and Ben both offsite developers?
Yeah, definitely. We have one guy, Jared West, who's our front-end developer JavaScript guy. He's here in the office with me. And then Ben is out in Australia, and Bruno is in Portugal.
Yeah, okay, so I've met Bruno a couple times, but I never really got a chance to talk to him. I didn't remember that he was in Portugal, because a friend of mine is also from Portugal, so we kind of got those guys together. But what do you find when, because Australia, that's, you know, a lot of time zones away from where you are in the United States, right? So
yeah,
how do you deal with the difference?
It's tough. But, again, it kind of depends on the person that you're working with. You know, people that have a strong work ethic, you can pretty much, you know, meet for an hour and talk about what you're going to do for the day and, you know, feel confident that the next day when you come back, it's going to be done or there's progress going to be made. So, yeah, telecommuting is pretty difficult, but I've honestly found people who telecommute seem to be it's kind of sketchy, but I guess maybe because every person I've hired that's telecommuted has always worked out very well, which is Bruno and Ben. So, but it's been kind of a great experience for me, and I don't know if it's because they're more relaxed and they have strong work ethics, but I don't really have a comparison of, you know, to compare to of someone who didn't work telecommute.
Yeah, so with my company, it's just my designer and I, and I'm in the Netherlands and he's in the United States. And so we basically meet once a day around, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock my time, which is probably like 9 a.m. his time.
Yeah.
And we just have like a kind of what would be equivalent of a stand-up meeting. And then we just go and we only really talk for any significant amount of time. And we have to do things like spec out a new project or something like that. And, you know, I feel it's like interesting because working off-site has kind of forced me to manage my projects more. Like, where previously I would just sit down and be talking back and forth across the seats, like, all day. Now I'm, you know, completely separated from the guy, and I can't get a hold of him if I wanted to because I'd be waking him up or whatever. And so, you know, we have to kind of have our story in some kind of format. So, like, we kind of do that with online with, like, task management software and whatnot. But it's worked out pretty well for us.
We use HipChat, and I confession on Bruno is Bruno's he actually enjoys working nights, so it kind of works out nice for us. He like starts work around 6 p.m. his time, and then works until like 3 or 4 in the morning, which I find crazy, but he does it. He enjoys it. So I'm not going to complain.
So yeah, that's nice for you. He's around while you're working.
Yeah. And I would say the most difficult part of telecommute is the fact that those stand-up meetings that you can have in person in front of a whiteboard are so much easier. We try so many different methods of, you know, doing a video chat with the laptop precariously placed in the spot that looks at the whiteboard and then, you know, stand up in front of it and talk. And it's worked somewhat well, but it's not the same as having someone in the office that you can directly, you know, face-to-face and talk and scope out a project. So it tends, you know, scoping projects tends to go a little bit slower, but it's the price you pay for telecommuting, I guess.
Yeah, I think we've kind of found the same thing. There's, like, initially getting something kind of rolling can be a little bit trickier, and there's a lot of, like, typing because you're just chatting or whatever. But once everybody's kind of, you know, rolling, then, you know, for the most part, it's been fine. We all telecommute as well, so we're not the distances you guys do. Everybody's within one time zone of each other, so it's not bad at all.
It's offsite though.
Yeah, everybody. I mean, everybody works at Userscape. So me and my wife work at Userscape, and then so we're in New York, and then everybody else is in the South, the United States Southeast. So in North Carolina and Virginia, or North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. So, yeah, so I mean,
eating
they're all
cakes and pies.
Right, they're eating cakes and pies. Barnesism. So, yeah, but, it's, so they're all off-site and, yeah, we use HipChat and we've done a little bit of the whiteboard in front of a wall with the computer kind of thing. And it's been okay. Just done that a couple times, but, overall, I'd say you, when we first were hiring and expanding, I was a little bit worried about that. We were actually going to, just build out a bigger office here in New York and have people move here, but it just seemed like, I don't know, once we started really diving in and finding people, you know, it just seemed like it just made sense to let everybody work from home. Like, I mean, I don't think either of the guys who work here now in terms of developers would probably have moved. And, you know, even if they did, it's like you're relocating people. It's a whole bunch of hassle involved in that. And it's just, it's not really that much of a downside to not have them around. And there's, you know, so many upsides to people, you know, just being home and comfortable and can work a little bit at their own pace and less distractions and all those things.
Yeah, I know for me, being able to work for a while and then get up and just take a walk or go right. somewhere for an infinite amount of time, whatever it takes for me to get back into like the mindset is fantastic. There's been a couple articles we've been tossing back and forth where people are talking about, you know, how so much of like a developer who's working at like a large company, so much of their time is spent fake working and right. looking up stuff yeah. on Reddit and cat pictures, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, I mean, I don't think people really want to spend all their time doing that in the first place. It's just, this is what they have to do to give their brain a break.
Yeah.
So
I also think there's a place for those brain breaks. It's like, and I think that's one of the things I almost find is like an upside, like in the sense of like, you know, if you just need a break and you just want to read this article that came across you on Twitter, like you can just read it and nobody's like walking by your cube being like, what are you doing? And you know what I mean? Like there's all those kind of aspects to things too, where like, yeah, I was just taking 10 minutes to like reset myself and it's no big deal. But, you know, in an office environment, it kind of can be a big deal. So it's just, you know, not that we would, again, it's a little tricky. Would we make it a big deal in our office? Probably not. But at the same time, there's just those kind of social pressures when you're all together, you know, that can sometimes be negative where it's, you know, it's just much more, you know, freeing if you're just on your own and then you're just, you know, communicating kind of as needed and as you go throughout the day.
Now, how much would you say your developers have a say in, you know, how the product turns out? Like, how flat would you say your decision-making structure is for your product?
Well, for us, you know, so we all came into it and we started building. We started working on a few other things early on with them, and then we decided we were going to, you know, move forward with a brand new product with Snappy. And so that's kind of been an interesting process because, you know, I have like all the domain knowledge. Neither Eric or Taylor's really, you know, worked in customer service before. So there was a lot of just like me building wiki pages of information and things like that. And then just building up the product to the baseline of everything that needs to be done. And so in terms of that kind of large scope of it, that tended to be more my area of it. But when you get down into like the details of everything, that's, you know, that's all those guys in terms of like the technical aspects of it. And then, and now I think we're starting to get to this good place where it's, easier as we move forward to, for everybody to kind of have opinions. Those guys are up to speed on what is required in terms of running a help desk and customer service and all those things. And they're doing it as well. So they're getting to see that, get that like firsthand knowledge of, you know, things that would make it easier and those kind of things. So, you know, it's definitely moving much more in that direction for us. And, you know, in terms of the actual structure of the organization, you know, it's definitely, I don't see us anytime soon not being completely flat, you know, other than, I guess, me. But it's like me and then everybody, you know, I don't see us having a lot of managers and, you know, all those kind of things, middle people, because I just think it's nicer to have a much flatter organization. And I think you can run with that for quite a while. Probably there's a certain point where maybe it doesn't work. Although more and more now you see like the GitHubs and, you know, Valve and those guys who are flat even with hundreds of people. So maybe it can even go bigger. So that'll be kind of interesting if we ever get that big. But it's not really a goal of mine actually to get that big. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, for us, we're pretty much completely collaborative. I'll come up with a user story for a package or an extension that we want to build, and I'll just type it up in Google Docs, and I'll write a quick user story about the features and what it's supposed to do. And then we all get up on that Google Doc, and we get on the phone or Skype, and we talk about it. And I would say, as far as the decision-making on how things are coded, I've kind of taken a backseat to that a lot recently. As long, you know, I still have that decision of saying, like, no, we need to do it this way, or I really wanted this feature to be in. But most of these guys can handle themselves. You know, they'll take the scope and come up with great ideas. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they come up with stuff I didn't even think about. So I would say our developers pretty much have a big say in how the end product turns out.
Based on Ben's talk at Laracon, where he kept asking people to basically question him so he could, you know, kind of try to learn from that and kind of grow as an individual, it really seems like he's the kind of guy who can take some, you know, criticism or take some, you know, recommendations or suggestions without being affected, you know, negatively.
Yeah, I think so. I think he's always pretty open. Yeah, I have a big thing here where we say, you know, one of the biggest problems with developers is they feel inadequate. They don't want to ask questions or dive in and learn new things, or they're hesitant because they don't know if they're going to do it the right way. And you see that in a lot of developers in the forums and different open source projects where, you know, the biggest things here is just dive in, build, and create. You know, it's you got to have that, you got to get past that. I think they call it like imposter syndrome or something like that.
Where
you feel, and you just got to get past that in order to not be afraid to ask those questions, even though you might be wrong. That's something I've said a couple times here, and I don't know if you took anything from that, but he's always been that type of guy where he asked me questions, you know, all the time in regards to, you know, why don't we do it like this, or how come we don't do it like this, or should we do it like that? And those always end up being like, yeah, you're right. I didn't even think about that. Let's do it that way. It's smarter.
So, Dan, have you, like, from a business perspective, run into any, like, challenges lately that have kind of been, you know, tough to deal with that you're willing to talk about?
Profitability?
Is that, like, an ongoing problem?
Yeah, I mean, we're continuing the trend, and we started out where we were funded through my partner, Al, who's a really great guy, and he really believes in the products that we're building. And then we started doing client work, and we're using that to fund, and now we're kind of switching over where we're starting to get enough subscribers that it's helping sustain some of our payroll, and the cost of development, which is, you know, just to keep things going is a lot, especially when you're so far away from an actual end product. So I think in the last month, we've all kind of gotten together and said, okay, solvency is a very important thing to us. Let's really pitch this message about, you know, we have 50 packages in our arsenal that you can sign up for a subscription, and we're going to say that's the way that you contribute to having the Cardlist e-commerce platform come out, kind of like a spin on crowdfunding where you actually get an immediate return for, you know, your investment into the project. And I think that's the biggest challenge, just getting keeping things going and just, you know, surviving. And I think everyone deals with that.
Yeah, so that brings up a couple questions in my mind. So it seems like to develop this platform, it's quite a long-term project, right? It's not like something that, you know, you have a handful of packages and they all come together and, you know, you're done in a year. It seems like you guys have been working on this for a while and you're engineering something that's kind of pretty large, right?
Yeah, you know, our goal has always been to create our infrastructure first. And a lot of our delays a little bit end up being with the, you know, we started on CodeIgniter, then we switched to Fuel, and then Laravel came out, and then Laravel 4, which is, you know, changed things. And now that we got Laravel 4 and Composer, everything's starting to feel really good. So now we're starting to make a lot more progress with a lot of our packages and platform, and we've already just started our e-commerce extensions with cart and conditions and attributes. And so we're actually feeling like we're starting to make progress on the actual product that we originally set out to build. But, you know, that whole process, you know, I don't regret at all because it brought us to the point that we are at now. And we've found a way that, you know, through Composer and Laravel 4 and using all of these different packages that that's the way that you want it to be as a developer, that you can include this package and use it for your platform and application, and you have all your dependencies and versions and everything like that, and your migrations handled for you. So, yeah, it's definitely kind of switched over from that we're just creating an e-commerce platform where we set out and we have these very specific features for an e-commerce system, and then we build it. We definitely have taken the time to say, let's build all of these pieces separately, make sure that they're framework agnostic and they can work everywhere. And then let's build a tool that brings them all together, and you can add and remove all these different components and modules to create any type of application. And that's probably the biggest thing that people, because of our name, Cardless, don't understand, is that our packages can be combined to create anything. So you can create a content management system if you just want that, or you can just use users and our API, and you can just create a really nice API for user management that you can use with Sentry and feed out for different projects.
Do you have like a education situation where you like go out and teach people how to use your tools to kind of, you know, create clients, create customers?
Yeah, not yet. It's something that, you know, even documentation, we say, we always like to, you know, documentation is most important, but the manpower that we have, it's just, it gets really tough. But we, you know, going forward, I think now that we have a lot of our infrastructure in place and a lot of our packages available, it's starting to get to the point that we aren't worried about 20 different things that we have to create. We're now just kind of down to one or two things that we need to create for this quarter. And we can go back through and start documenting and really start doing tutorials and screencasts and things like that. But no, definitely no plans for education where people can go out and we can teach them how to use the system. It's a good idea, though.
It seems to me that if you can kind of make things very accessible, almost make them like so that the user kind of comes to your wherever and the knowledge is fed into their brain, it seems to me that That is a way that you can really get people like to rely on you. I actually even built my business that I've been running for like a little over 2 years off of CodeIgniter tutorials, honestly, on my blog. I had a website and just I wrote a bunch of CodeIgniter tutorials, and I started getting requests to make apps. And so I was like, maybe I'll just kind of cut back to 20 hours a week at my job and start making apps for people. And, you know, over time, it's just kind of like a side note ramble. I started my business with my partner because we wanted to make our own apps and to own those ourselves and kind of have passive income coming in and try to solve some problems that we had with whatever apps are out there in the same market.
Mm-hmm.
What we ended up doing is spending years just turning over client work because we couldn't figure out really exactly how to have that income that could sustain us to make something that wasn't immediately going to be profitable.
Right.
And so I think about 2.5 years, almost 3 years into the whole process, we finally figured out how to function as a agency that turns over client work. And now, you know, we've kind of found this sweet spot where we can start working on our own stuff again. So I think that there's like, at least for us, this time where you know, like programmers, we're a programmer, a designer, and we had to figure out how to run a business because, you know, I'm not a business major or anything even close. And so it took us a while to figure all that stuff out, and not just to figure it out, but to build the clients and to, you know, make a name for ourselves so that we could get, you know, work that was a little bit more targeted to our strengths and less just happen to come in.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we spend so long with one goal and it takes years just to even start to realize that. And client work, at the end of the day, it's what's sustaining everything that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not a startup and you don't have, you know, those millions of dollars, however they get that funding for that specific service or application that you're building, client work's the heartbeat of your company. I mean, you got to continually turn it over, and the more that you turn it over to remain profitable and make your living, the less time that you have to focus on your internal goals. I think any startup or business deals with that quite a bit. How do you manage that? I guess just becoming a better team.
Well, too, especially nowadays where like having that like really good baseline of income is so important if you're going to start your own business, because most of the apps that you're probably going to build, if your goal is to make apps, you know, are going to be SaaS apps if you're talking about web development. And, you know, that's a lot different than like when I started HelpSpot, because we started HelpSpot and the average sale of HelpSpot is $1,000. So, you know, the first month we made $4,000 or something like that. And like the next month we made $8,000. And so it's like, oh wow, $8,000. Like that was more, you know, way more than I made in a month at my job. And so it was a lot of upfront money, which kind of then can propel you forward. But with the SaaS app, even with Snappy, you know, you could see it's like, you know, over the course of a year, you might make that same amount of money on a same size sale, but you don't get all that money up front, generally speaking. So, you know, it's here's $100. Okay, you know, and here's $100. That's fine, but you know, you're not going to get 4,000 or 8,000 all at once. So you kind of need to have that baseline so that you can, you know, afford to live and keep building the product and making it better while you transition, you know, over the course of a couple of years and you build up, you know, the application base to something that, yeah, once it's, you know, $10,000 a month or $20,000 a month, $30,000 a month. Okay. Now it's self-sustaining and you can hire people with that type of money and, you know, you can go forward with that. But there is like a longer ramp up time now, I think, than in the past actually, because, you're generally not getting as much upfront money as you might have in the past with on-premise applications that you were building.
Yeah. That's how we feel. You know, any type of SaaS service that's subscription-based, you're always waiting for that next cycle.
Right.
You know, we charge like quarterly upfront, so basically equates to about $20 a month per developer. And we charge for a quarter, so you know, out of the box for a subscription to Arsenal, it's $60. But then you have to wait another 3 months to get that next $60 if they like what you have. But it's always building on top of each other, too, as long as your attrition rate isn't very high or your cancellation rate isn't very high. And ours has been pretty low. So it's the fun part of that is that you get to see it grow and not kind of worried about selling one thing. Like right now we're confident that, okay, well, this whole subscription thing and our subscribers are working. They're staying subscribed and they're using our stuff on a daily basis. So we can kind of say that if somebody subscribes, you're going to be with us for a little while. And so we're always, you know, you wait till that next quarter comes along and your subscription count is just climbing and climbing and climbing. So, maybe not always as fast as you want it to be, but it's definitely more, I guess, secure in feeling that you have those subscriptions always coming back, because like what you're talking about with selling your application one time, or right. I don't know if it was one time or if it was, you know, once a year, right. But for that high dollar amount, well, if somebody else comes out with something better, you know, do those go away? You know, you got to keep selling.
Right. No, you do always have that. Even now, I still have that fear. The new month rolls around. I'm like, oh, man, this is the month that nobody's going to buy HelpSpot again. I just know it. But it doesn't turn out that way, luckily. But, yeah, there's definitely a lot of – it does level out the risk in that way. That you know, so you wait a little longer for it, but then at the same time, it's definitely – assuming you don't, you know, have a huge implosion of some type, it's theoretically at least, you know, should be much more stable and predictable, which is why everybody likes it.
That's made things easier for everybody. I mean, it always used to be that you had a bunch of different applications that you paid one time for and you put them all together. Or in the open source world, you know, you're always trying to find your form software and your CMS software and put them all together, and you'd have to integrate them to get it to work. But now, nowadays, everything's kind of going to that SaaS model or that PaaS model. So now as a company, you're finding that you have maybe a lower end, but you have a longer sustainability. And once you get hooked on those subscriptions you enjoy them, you know, you kind of stay a part of that. So, you know, you have, like for us, we have, you know, we pay for our GitHub private repositories, pay for our deployment software, which is a subscription, our Help Ticket software, which is a monthly subscription. And I think, you know, I think that's where everything's kind of going.
Yeah. I have so many SaaS subscriptions, I don't even know how many. It's like dozens, literally. Like, it's crazy, but that is where it's going. What about you, Sean? When are you guys going to hire your third person?
Well, we brought somebody on for a little bit, but that didn't really work out. And then, so when I actually went through the whole, hey, everybody on Twitter, I'm looking for a developer, submit a resume. And, it was actually, the turnout was pretty good. And there, I think, were a number of, you know, very strong developers. And, we kind of ended up in a situation where, you know, circumstances that we couldn't have predicted made somebody's life a little bit harder than, you know, necessarily we thought it was going to be. So it didn't really work out. But by the time that was all over, see, I didn't know anybody in the Netherlands, at that point in time. So I was kind of just like, I don't know any developers, kind of, you know, what am I going to do? But now, I've been in the community, and, you know, we kind of built a Laravel community here, and I've met some really great developers. So we kind of have a third guy who is not really, like, on our team, but he has his own little, like, one-man freelancing company, and we just use him all the time. And he's the kind of guy who is really interested in, you know, just, like, growing, and he takes criticism really well, and it's just, in general, he's just like a really good fit for us, and so we just kind of keep going with him. And honestly, I think it's really difficult when you have such a small team. It's just like me and my designer, and we very much are like masters of our own domain. I haven't used CSS in like 5 years since I started working with this guy, and I don't remember anything, and I'm so thankful for this. And you know, he handles all of that, and he's very technical. You know, he has all these build tools, and he, you know, he runs Linux, and he uses Dvorak keyboard, and he's like a really smart, really technical guy, but he's like a great designer, and I really respect him. And we kind of divide up our roles so that in the end of the day, it's like the product is a product he created. He designed it. But, you know, we talk through our vision, and we talk through everything together. And I design all of the system stuff, first of all. I have kind of a, like a Linux systems background, and I deal with all that. Then I do the server side stuff, and I choose the technologies there and everything, and I handle all of that. And together we basically end up making applications that are kind of unified in vision, and we're a really good team in that way. So like bringing somebody on, I really discovered it's very difficult because we rely on that cooperation to even have a business at all. You know, without that, you know, without having worked together for so long, I don't know that we would be even effective in turning over the quality of work that, you know, we kind of defines our price point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
And so, finally, meeting developers locally and working with them and coming to, you know them, that's given me the opportunity to find people that I want to work with, where just randomly calling out to other people doesn't seem to, you know, it's impossible. It feels like to just say, hey, come, everybody who's looking for a job, come talk to me. It just doesn't even, it makes sense now, you know. I have to go and scout people, and then if they're not in a place where they can work with me, like they're happy with their jobs, or, you know, maybe they have a, they just had a kid or something like that, and they don't feel like taking a risk on a small company situation.
Yeah.
Then it's tough. And like, so there's really a very limited pool to pull from.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely a big believer that, like, most of the really great people already have jobs. So it's a little bit, when, you know, you just kind of ask for resumes, it definitely is a mixed bag at best. And then it's just a lot of work to go through there, too. And with consulting, too, it's kind of different because you always, it's a little bit more variable, you know. And so, you know, you got to be careful there. Obviously, you don't want to overcommit to people, and then you have a lull in work or whatever, and you know that's not always great.
It's hard too when you're like, yeah, I don't know exactly how much time I can promise you.
Right. So, interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just it's a really strange situation. And, my personal goal is to have as few people involved as possible, because you know obviously it adds a lot of overhead, and who wants to deal with the overhead? I don't want to become a project manager full time. I mean, that's right. Just not what I want to do. And so, people who you know, like you said, have that like entrepreneurial experience, who can, you know, you can kind of interact with them, do some discovery with a client, kind of give them direct access to the client, you know that the client's going to feel like they've been taken care of and the product's done. That's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to have to tell somebody, you know, what to do, what to make.
Right. Yeah. And it's tricky to find those people.
Yeah. What's interesting is this crew we kind of built out here. We're all working on something kind of special right now.
Uh-oh.
We're rebuilding the Laravel.io site. It's a community portal right now. And what it basically is a buddy and I kind of got a wild hair to make a site with a bunch of Laravel screencasts and tutorials and kind of do a study guide type thing where like every week we would go through a part of a source or something like that.
Mm.
And it kind of, you know, evolved into this thing where we're hosting the forums now, and we have a wiki, and you know our IRC has chat logs that are searchable. Somebody made MongoDB type app, and you can just go in there. Like if you go to Laravel.io and just click chat or whatever the hell the link is, I don't know, and like right there you can join the chat. But in that page you can actually review logs and search through the history.
Geez, I didn't even know about that. That's a good one. Yeah. That's useful.
Yeah, and so it's a lot of really cool stuff, but we've been wanting to re-envision it for a long time, and I've tried. Like at Laracon US in February, I showed Taylor some of the work we were doing, where we had indexed a bunch of stuff with Elasticsearch, and we were doing this real-time faceted search results. So you had this unified Laravel search system, and it returned blogs and API and docs and everything. And just the workload was just too much, and I couldn't keep up with it. And so all that stuff is basically just thrown away code at this point. But at Laracon EU, the staff got together, and you know, when everybody's out partying and whatnot, we were exhausted. You know, our recording staff have been on their feet all day, recording from multiple angles, and you know, everybody was just tired. And so we went back to the loft that we rented for the staff, and we decided just to sit down and just do a hackathon. And we were like, "What should we code? Let's make that new Laravel.io site." So, turns out that the Wi-Fi was dead, so we didn't get anywhere. But we kind of sketched out what we wanted it to be. And now that we have five people working on it, it's me, Nick Spelt, Dries Fintz, Mitchell Fun, Weinharde, and Justin Sider. And basically, everybody's actually like working on it now. So it's not just like me anymore. It's like a whole group of people. And so when you see somebody go in and say, "Hey, look what I just built," you're like all of a sudden motivated to go do more on your part. And so I think that we will be ready for launch within the next couple of weeks. And the interesting thing about this is it's going to replace the Laravel Pastebin. It's going to replace the current IO site with all of its articles. And we're also doing away with the Laravel forums.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a big deal, and it was not a decision that we came to lightly, but we have Taylor's blessing, and we're just going to lock the forums down and just keep them there for, you know, forever. Basically, we don't want to lose all of the knowledge that has been, you know, entered into that system, but we create our own forums, and we have our own new Pastebin, and we have our own article system, and everything is behind a single sign-in. And you sign in through authenticating through GitHub. So you don't actually have to do anything to have an account. You just go log into GitHub, and if you're already logged into GitHub, it just says authorize, and then you're in, and you have access to everything.
Yeah.
And you can store your paste long term. You can post to the forum. And in addition, people can post their own articles, and they don't have to have us curate the articles or approve them or anything. You can essentially, if you want to, make your own Laravel blog on the new Laravel.io just by, you know, going to your username on the site. So all your posts are aggregated there. And then the community can, you know, determine the quality of the post, and the higher quality stuff rises to the top. And so that's kind of where we are now, and I'm really excited about that. I think it's going to be a really interesting system, and I'm not sure, but it might be the most ambitious framework community project I've seen.
Yeah, there's not a lot of, you know, in terms of a unified kind of community setup, there's definitely not. I think Taylor told me a little bit about this earlier today, actually, and I was like, they should sell that. Or they should do something with that, because, like, every open source, you know, every kind of sizable open source project out there, it sounds kind of useful.
Well, the kind of the cool thing about it is it's all written in Laravel 4, and the whole site's open source. So, like,
there we go.
What we have right now is right now available on GitHub. So the idea is we're trying to use, you know, just like the Laravel best practices, PHP best practices, build the site. So not only is the site for, you know, people to come and get help and learn more, they can actually turn to the site as an example of a fairly, like, it's not a trivial application. It's absolutely not. So you can see how, you know, we built this application on Laravel 4, and, you know, we use everything from, all kinds of stuff. I don't even know where to start. But I've specifically created packages on packages just so that I could use them in this app, distilling code I've made on other projects, and bringing them over. So, I mean, it's a really cool project, and we have a really good team, and I'm really excited to have, you know, people get in and make articles and have the site, because the current site is just it's all me moderating everything, because there's not even an admin. It's like, if you want to make a post, send me a markdown file and I'll add it to the database manually, because, like, we went lean as possibly could be. But now, like, I'm not in the way of anything. So, we have multiple people administrating the repo. So I'm not the hold up on pull requests. I'm not the hold up on article posts or anything, and we have a lot of really interesting stuff planned with, like, curating pastes. Like, pastes can have comments, and, you know, they can be forked and everything, but they can be curated so that they, are kind of stored and tagged in their own system. And there's a lot of really interesting stuff. Like, the goal is to take all of this content that's just being created around the clock, just these forum posts and these pastes that everyone's making, and try to utilize that data and reuse it instead of just going through the same. Because I don't know if you go to the Laravel support channel, it's the same stuff every day, all right. The time. And so
that's the world of customer service. Even in the open source world, it's all the same.
Yeah. So I think I tried to start this project where we get a whole bunch of developers together and we write a bunch of articles covering the topics that come up most frequently. And,
right,
you know, that wasn't a failure, but the core idea is fundamentally flawed in that there's still an authority that has to overwatch the whole entire thing.
Yeah.
And so now, basically, you know, we kind of focus on removing the authority and put the power in the community's hands and let the community determine what this thing's going to become. And I really want to see what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
That should be good.
That's really cool. I mean, one of the things, I don't know if you recall, like, we for Laravel version 3, Taylor he spent the first couple months at Userscape just basically building the parts of version 3 that version 2 didn't have that we were going to need for all the stuff we were going to do at Userscape. So and during that time, Eric and Taylor somewhat as well worked on the bundle site, and it had GitHub login, and we had always thought, okay, like, we could expand it into more, you know, that would be, like, the first step, and it just never went farther than that. And then 4 came out, and the bundle site was kind of worthless at that point anyway, so that all kind of, you know, disappeared. But this is great. I mean, it's definitely going to be a huge resource. Even just the original one, I still think is, you know, had a lot of good stuff on it, but this sounds over the top, so that should be pretty cool.
Yeah, excited.
Have you guys found the, like, you know, because you obviously spend a lot of time on, you know, Laravel and being part of the community. You're in IRC all the time, and you're building community sites and all these things. Like, has that directly affected your guys' business, or has business kind of been, you know, is your primary lead source still outside of Laravel, or is that a primary generator for you guys now?
You know, I'm not really taking on like new business at any point in time anymore. It seems like the word of mouth is basically the way that we operate now, as far as client work. So for a long time, it was, you know, like I said, the Code Igniter screencasts and tutorials and everything. Yeah. At some point in time, though, it became people who have talked to other people that we've worked for. And it stopped being, you know, other sources. So we still get, you know, a lot of client contracts, potential clients come in and say, hey. But mostly we turn people away because we have kind of worked with people and then, you know, determined, is this a good fit for us or not? Are these clients, do they think the way that we think? Do they want to make the same kind of applications that we want to make? Does the type of work fit? Does the, you know, the money, does the money work? And,
right.
and all of these things, and eventually we ended up with a couple clients that, you know, are good to work with, have similar philosophies as us, have, you know, products that we can stand behind, like mommeetmom.com, for example.
Right.
The moms, there's three moms that are behind that whole thing. They are not only brilliant, but in their own individual ways are kind of like really awesome at different fields. And so they're really great to work with. We learn a lot from them, and we feel like we have the ability to make an impact. So let's say somebody, a client wants like a slider on their front page, you know, we can just say, hey, look, the evidence, the studies show that, you know, the sliders have like no engagement whatsoever. Let's see what you're trying to do and find something that, you know, we can measure has an actual effect. And, you know, with our current clients, we have that kind of relationship and we can, you know, talk frankly and we can do all those things. So we've really curated kind of our clientele to the point where at this point we have enough recurring work with the people that we like to work with that we're not really taking new business. But what we are doing is like, you know, maybe every once in a while we subcontract something, to developers that we know and trust locally, like people I know in real life and see a couple times a week.
Right.
And I get to work with them, and we all like working together. We learn a lot from working with each other, and sometimes we do, you know, like the fancy agile type stuff, and like code review is always a really fun exercise for everyone to go through. So for me as a developer, working with like a full-time designer, working with another developer is a treat, a pleasure. But yeah, for us at this point in time, I think that we're really happy with our clients. And, you know, if something happened, if like one of our clients decided that they were going out of business or going elsewhere or whatever, we might consider doing something else. But at this point in time, you know, it's hard to find what we have now.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go out of my way to wreck it.
Right. Yeah, no, it sounds like it's nice when you get to that place where you just have a kind of trusted, you know, reliable customer base. And yeah, sometimes the grass isn't always greener on the other side there. So
yeah, at the end of 2012, I made the terrible mistake of taking too much client work. And so every single project I was involved with, like, lagged, and it was just a horrible experience. So I learned a lot from that. And it took me until halfway through 2013 to even fix it.
Right.
And so I think I'd rather take less work and have that work be of more reliable nature.
Yeah.
Just so that I don't end up overworked and under delivering to my clients. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how much, you know, when you build custom applications for people, like just us building the couple apps we have, it's like a tremendous amount of work. So whenever I think of, you know, people who are doing it on a consulting basis, it's just incredible to think how much work goes into those, and doing that kind of over and over, that kind of would scare the bejeebers out of me, I think, trying to estimate it or figure out how much time something's going to take. That whole kind of world is, I find, kind of fascinating, actually.
I really enjoy it. I love estimation and figuring out, you know, what the budget of things is going to be. And I've been doing this for a really long time, and I feel pretty confident that I know like how much time it's going to take me to build something.
Yeah.
And I've said this before, but I really think that a lot of times what happens is a developer will have a decent idea of what it'll actually take, because, you know, they've made a lot of mistakes before and they're ready to pad that number up in their head. But then they kind of go to their management, and the management says, this number doesn't sound like people will accept it.
Yeah,
and
right.
So then they have to say, okay, well, I guess I'm going to come up with another number now. And then when
– come up with the right number.
Yeah, but when the management comes back and says you're over budget, and then suddenly it feels like the developer's fault, because the developer was kind of pressured into coming up with a number that they didn't honestly believe in. So I really believe that a lot of developers are better at measuring how much time something takes than they're given credit for. It's just that – you know, people aren't going to always accept the real cost up front. And sometimes, you know, you're going to pay the real cost one way or another. And, you know, the worse you make your developers feel, that's probably not going to help.
That is, one of those advantages of kind of being small and staying small is, like, you know, you're in total control of that scenario. Obviously, if you become a bigger agency, then, like, the sales team's trying to sell, which means they're trying to, you know,
yeah, there's like a tension.
Get lower numbers, right? But the development team knows how long it takes to build things, and you know, then each side's trying to pad in one way or the other because they know they're going to have a fight with the other side. It kind of gets messy there, unless you have a really really good team.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine. Like, I don't even want to grow as a team past, you know, like maybe three developers or something, because at this point in time, it's just so easy for us. You know, I mean, not easy, but like relatively easy for us to make enough to pay our bills. But once other people start coming on, you know, I get pulled out of development because I'm going to be the one who's interacting with these other developers. And, you know, I'm kind of like super fast when it comes to coding stuff. Like, I just like throw it down.
Yeah.
And, when I come out of development, it's like development basically stops. And, I don't even know what it would be like to, because you have to be able to work with the customers and the, you know, do discovery and do regular meetings just to make sure everybody's, you know, on the same page and everything. And it's scary thinking of somebody representing me in those meetings without me being there.
I can understand that.
Is there anything you want to talk about before we kind of like wrap it up? I want to thank you both very much for sponsoring Laracon EU. It's amazing, you, like, how much, like, I will never look at sponsorship the same now that I've been through that whole process, because you just rely so much on the sponsors to even be able to do anything. So selling tickets and whatnot is fine, but mostly you're not going to get that money until after the event's over.
Yeah.
And so you're relying on sponsorship to be able to actually fund the initial, like, deposits and everything that goes into, like, flying speakers out and taking care of all of that.
Yeah.
And
it's crazy.
Yeah. So thank you so much. We literally couldn't have run that conference without your companies and your support.
Hey, no problem. It was great. Great excuse to go to Amsterdam too, which was awesome. It's awesome to finally get over there and check it out. So it was great, and venue was great. The whole thing was all top notch.
Excellent job.
I think we're gonna do it again.
Uh oh, that an official announcement?
Well, we're already working on it.
Oh my goodness!
Wow.
I learned a lesson that, you know, from starting, because like we came out of Laracon US in late February, right? Like basically March. And we said to ourselves, if we're going to have another conference, we have to begin immediately. And even no matter how early we began, like all of the hotels were basically sold out in Amsterdam already. Because we had planned on the summer in Amsterdam. And it's like tourism central, right?
Yeah.
So it became a very difficult situation for people, I think, because usually you go to a conference and you expect, here's the conference, right? Here's the hotel. Done and done.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was. Yeah, the hotel situation was pretty wild. Just even when I was getting it, it was like, whoa, there's really not a lot of hotels, and or they're just all booked.
Yeah, I think we ended up staying like 20 minutes away from Amsterdam. But it worked out. Got to see the countryside.
So I think this time we'd like to do the same thing, but kind of focus on improving the areas that were obviously a negative. And we did a survey of the attendees, And we got back a lot of really good information. I think that people want hands-on, like, workshop-type situations. So I think a lot of people would like a three-day conference with, and this is not me announcing plans, I'm just kind of responding to the feedback, right, with the same number of speakers, but with more, like, hands-on interactive, like, workshops, like sitting down and coding with people like the speakers and people like Taylor, you know.
Yeah.
Who can kind of give some insight into things. I think that has so much value. You know, who doesn't want to sit down with somebody who they really respect as a developer and just code with them for a while? And,
right,
you know, whenever anybody gets a chance to do something like that, you come away like with a different perspective, and it changes who you are. And I think a lot of the value of conferences is exactly that. I think that's where, you know, you want to come back thinking about development a little differently or having new tools in your, you know, toolkit or whatever.
Yeah, that's like we've been kicking around kind of Laravel US. Just we actually haven't started any serious planning yet, which we probably should. But because I don't know, that first one just beat the heck out of us, and then going to yours, we're a little bit like, okay, like we got to get rolling again here. But yeah, trying to figure out maybe some different things to do. That's just beyond the kind of, you know, speakers and the kind of standard thing. So we don't really have anything solid yet, but we're trying to think of some different outside the box things maybe to try to do to make it a little bit different and give people some more unique interactions and things of that nature.
You should do some lightning talks.
Lightning talks. I really like lightning talks. That's a good idea. I've talked about that a little bit already. There's a business of software conference I go to every year, and they do lightning talks, and those are usually really great. Like, it's just a chance to get to meet some of the audience and get some of that knowledge that's in the audience out there. And also kind of breaks it up from the standard, you know, hour of somebody standing up there. It's just 5 minutes, you know, real quick and fast and
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, running a conference is something. I know after you get done with it, you're like, whoa, that's intense.
Yeah. I don't want it to all come up at once. Cause like, I didn't have any contacts in Amsterdam or anything related, right, to conferences and caterers, et cetera. And so we had to kind of like start from scratch, and it almost feels like a shame if we don't make use of those contexts.
Right. Now you kind of know how to do it. So.
Right. So, you know, hopefully next year, you know, we run a good venue, get some hotels set up for people. I should probably stop talking about this because it's not 100% sure that everything's going to work out. But
that's it. People are lining up already.
We got really good responses on the survey. I think like 98% of all attendees that were asked if they were going to show up again said that they would. Like just straight up yes. Like no maybe anything. So I feel overall pretty good about it. I definitely know in my mind so many ways in which I'm going to improve this situation. Like, for example, I'm going to get a host. I'm going to get somebody to host that's not me.
Yeah.
And because somebody who's actually like, you know, good at talking to people and all that stuff. I'm not like a super outgoing guy, so I just have like a whole list of things I want to fix over last time. So it should be good if we do it. No promises, right. But
asterisk.
Yeah, that's cool. This is like an awkward thing to start talking about on a podcast. Like, oh, you know, we're going to do this big thing, but.
Well, I'm always looking for ways to write off trips to Europe, so let's keep them coming.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, we better call it quits or else everybody's going to fall asleep in their car.
All right. Sounds good, man. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you.
See you guys around.
Okay, good.
How do I sound? Voice is my passport. Please verify. Name that movie.